Indraneel, welcome to the Commerce Talks podcast. It's our first time talking with a guest from India. So I'm super excited because India was part of my discussion in the Kassenzone podcast about booming markets in 2024. We're going to talk about a business where I'd like to have like access to the products because it looks really delicious on your website. We're going to talk about this in a minute. Maybe introduce yourself to the audience and introduce your company for a minute so we can start the discussion about the delicious products.
Sure. So firstly, Alex, thanks for hosting me on your podcast. Really nice to come on your podcast, which is talking about commerce and businesses. To give you a brief introduction about myself, my name is Indraneel Chitale. I'm a fourth generation partner at Chitale Bandhu. We are a 83-year-old organization that was started in 1939. And that way, I took the responsibility of this organization in 2016. And I've been working in it since 2011. I am responsible for the omni-channel product business that we have, where we operate through a channel of about 85 stores, about 500,000 retailers who sell our product. Then that is across 10 states and 2 union territories in India. And we export our product to about 30 plus countries. And along with that, we see a growing business that is happening with the help of digital businesses, which includes e-commerce, website sales, and quick commerce. And that way, the responsibility of this balance sheet and P&L is something that I've been handling, and that's what I'm here to talk about.
And for the people that are like living here in Europe or in the US that maybe have not seen like your brand in the shelves of their supermarkets, can you describe what you're selling? So I can see it on the website, but I would describe it the wrong way because maybe I'm using the wrong words here.
Yes. So we are manufacturers of Indian sweets and snacks, and that's why majority of our products in India are either based out of milk or milk products and converted into value-added products and snacks, which are usually fried with the help of a lot of spices and oils, and that way packaged in the form of pouches and sold across. So we do export to Germany as well. And that way we have a couple of distributors located all across the boundary. But predominantly our sale right now is through the network of Indian stores in Europe. And as a trade boundary, because of the restrictions on dairy products in Europe coming in from Asia or India, that way we sell about 40% of our product range in Europe at this moment.
Okay, interesting. Very cool. Before we are going a bit more like into your omnichannel strategy and how it changed over the last decades, maybe let's talk about the Indian market. So when I talked with Florian Heinemann, he's like a regular podcast guest on my German speaking podcast about the Indian market. We tried to do some research before, and there's like in the newspapers in Germany, like in the manager newspapers, you can find articles speaking very highly about like the momentum India gained over the last couple of years. And some articles are claiming it might be like the next China. So pretty good progress for the next 10, 20 years, streets, infrastructure, whatever. Everything is coming up there. And instead of like focusing on go-to-market movement into South America or maybe even China, so India might be the best market to go right now. You are living there. You have lived through it last couple of years. What's your perspective here? And you have a good understanding about the international market. So how is the situation really right now?
Well, I think we are just about starting of a golden age in India in terms of how the economy is going to roll out. So till the 1990s, India was a very socialist nation, and we had a very restricted market practice in India. So in 1991, the country decided to be liberalized about its economic policy and allow foreign direct investment. And that actually fueled the growth of the digital and the software services sector in this country. And eventually that led to a lot of capital in the hands of people, and a stable, educated workforce was able to be employed here. And that momentum actually picked up even further in the last decade, where we've seen that with the help of a very stable government, which has lasted for just over a decade now in India, they have been able to drive the right kind of social practices along with the economic policy, as well as fund the growth of the country in the most linear and sustainable manner. So this has led to us growing in from about a $2 trillion economy to just over $4 trillion in the size. And as a country, we are all gearing up in the next 1 and 1.5 year that we'll be a $5 trillion economy and probably the fourth largest economy in the world. So what this translates into is that you have about 1.5 billion people here who are all going to be beneficiaries of this growth in the Indian economy and have more cash in their hand to spend on consumer products and other services. And what's going to be valued more is the service and the quality. And with the help of the digitalization that has happened in this country over the past 6-7 years, where now every person can just pay with a QR code and a phone, and every consumer is a person with a phone, and with 5G rolling out at the fastest speed in the world in this country, we are poised for a phenomenal growth in this coming decade as well. And while doing that, what's incredible about India is that India is focusing heavily on the sustainability aspect of it, where the energy generation, the usage of fuels, the creation of infrastructure, and overall public infrastructure generation is a top priority to improve the cost and the impact on nature. So that's why we are very bullish on the Indian market. We are very happy about it. And that way, this growth of India and the per capita income of Indians is going to be the reason why intrinsic growth is going to be very much possible for Indian brands. And that's why it's a great marketplace for other brands and other nations to invest into as well.
So in this growth, you're saying consumers will have more cash on hands that eventually has to be translated in higher salaries. And we are seeing this in some of the offshoring businesses we are involved in. So what you're saying is, so India will move out of this like cheap labor market, like where every bigger company tries to have like a big developer hub in India because it's so cheap and you can hire senior developers for $1,000 a month. So this time is coming to an end, and therefore like the qualifications are getting higher. But you're also saying the Indian economy is managing creating enough jobs for this new consumers. Is that the case? Because this is obviously something where China is struggling right now.
So I think just like how it has happened with China, right now India's biggest strength and about 50% of its GDP is coming in from the services sector, which is something that will eventually peak or mature because of the high technical knowledge required in that sector. But India's manufacturing sector, which was once its backbone, but now just about 17-18% of the GDP, is something that is slated to grow. And with the help of the China plus one policy that most of the European companies and American companies have been adopting in terms of sourcing, there is a huge population that will be employed in the manufacturing sector, which can or cannot be highly skilled, but very good in terms of creating the right kind of output. So this disparity that has existed in India is something that the second tier of this economy will be employed at a better scale right now in the coming decade. So while there will be a class which is higher, which is employed in the service and the technology sector, the manufacturing sector will actually create stable jobs for the people who were once below the poverty line, but who've now been able to come out of it over the last decade.
Okay. And is there anything that could even develop faster or better because still it's a country that is managed by like different layers, like it's not like a communist state like China. So there's like many people that do have a say, and there's a very very complex structure in the different regions of India. And this was usually like the reason where people said, okay, you know, India will never have the same trajectory like China or other fast growing countries because it's way too big, way too complex, too many very different interests that cannot be aligned. But how is this working? So is everybody really focusing on economic growth? So are all interests aligned right now? That seems like a miracle.
Yeah, well, so just like how it was with Europe, India is very much like Europe, where our states are the size of the countries in Europe. And that way, every country has its own history and philosophy and idea of what they want to grow on. And I think that diversity will continue to exist in this country. But what has happened is that because of the stable government at the center over the last decade, country has understood that economics and generation of jobs and growth of economy needs to be independent of the localized politics that are happening.
Okay.
So you will keep having a more democratic society than what a communist regime like China has. But irrespective of it, everybody is focused only on growth because that is the only way we can create a more balanced society in this country where disparity was one of the biggest problems.
So, but then you would agree, like with the news or with the articles that came out in Europe or in the Western world, that it most likely is like the booming region of the next decade, and it's a place to be. It's not like your colleagues or peer group is trying to move out of India, moving into San Francisco, LA. It's like the other way around, saying, okay, let's rather go back from LA into Mumbai or like another big city, and let's create something here, because like the economic perspective, the future is so bright. Is this how I can describe it?
Absolutely. And I think that is also a reflection of what my senior team is doing as well, where two of my senior general managers, who essentially are the C-suite that we call, are somebody who moved back from Europe and US over the last year, just because they found India to be a stable market to grow into and actually create an impact here. So we are seeing that kind of talent migration, which was something that didn't happen two decades ago or one decade ago. Where I remember I was talking to this friend of mine from HBS, and he had the same question that, you know, why is it that the Chinese people move back, but the Indians don't move back from India? And we are seeing that happening over this last 3-4 years. Mm. And I think, you know, based on the way the trajectory and all the economic policies are being planned for this country, we will have a even bigger migration of talent moving back to India, and probably more global citizens making India their home to see and, you know, be part of the growth story that India is.
Ah, interesting. Okay, very good excourse into macroeconomic development. But let's focus now on your company and your trajectory. So just for me to clarify, you're operating 85 stores on your own. Is this correct? It's part of your omnichannel strategy?
Yes, yes.
And why is that? Because the major part of the business must be like a wholesale business where you're delivering your products into other supermarkets. And like let's compare it. Maybe I know Nestle is bigger, but let's take an example. Like for the European countries, Nestle is not operating own supermarkets, although they could have. But yeah, their core business is like wholesale business. Their product should be distributed over wholesale partners like Aldi, Rewe, Kortinklass. So what led to the decision to create your own stores?
Well, so my family started with the dairy business, where we end up processing almost close to 1 million liters of milk every day. And back in the 50s, when the technique of pasteurization or preservation of milk was not very well established as much as it is today, the only way to preserve milk was to convert it into milk products. And that way, that is how our store business came into existence, where we started selling milk products in the stores itself. So the store business actually happened first and the distribution business happened later. Oh. And that's why that continues to exist the way it is. And what we've come to see is that now the store is not just a mechanism of physical sale, but it is also enablement for digital sale as well, where even though the store operational timings could be just 12 hours, but we can service orders for more than 18 hours there by making it a dark kitchen as well and enabling it into digital platforms where people can order sitting in their home. So that's why these stores are located in the very highly penetrated urban markets of India. And we are actually able to bring down our time to delivery and delivery of fresh products to the consumers much quicker than even a supermarket could do. And secondly, also test our products with a loyal set of consumers and see what demands more scale and investments for automating and putting into supermarkets.
But those stores you're operating are not selling then only your products, but also products from other manufacturers. Is this correct?
No. So the 85 stores that I'm talking about, they are our exclusive branded stores. And there are about 500,000 stores that will sell our product. But these will be multi-brand stores, which will sell maybe our 300-400 other brands as well.
So how many items are you producing? How many SKUs are you producing?
So we produce close to about 530 SKUs every day.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, that is like enough, like for one store to fill the shelves.
That helps improve the viability of that.
Okay, store. And then so you're selling it's Indian sweets and snacks, so salty businesses and salty products. When I had a podcast with one of the biggest manufacturer of chocolate products, he told me, you know, high quality chocolate might be a thing like in Europe, but it's just like moving outside this kind of boundary. It's like in Asian countries like India or China, it's like it's just upcoming. Is this true? So when like an Indian customer is thinking about like sweet products, he's not thinking about chocolate, because that would be the case in Europe. A sweet product usually is kind of connected with like a chocolate-based raw product. That's not the case yet.
Well, so it's picking up. But what we see is that, you know, so we call Indian sweets as mithai. And the mithai is something that was cooked at scale and sold fresh. Unlike that, the chocolates are something that are always packaged and sold through a cold chain, probably at wherever required. So now there is a growing demand for a more hybrid version of either, where it's called gourmet mithai.
Gourmet mithai. Okay.
Gourmet. So gourmet is probably a English or a French word.
Yeah.
And mithai is the traditional Indian word, where what they've been doing is making a fusion of chocolates, which are presented in a more appealing form factor with the mix of Indian ingredients as well as some products into it, and presented together as a dessert more than anything else.
Okay. And the products you're selling, so how much of these are like convenience snack and salty products, which you like store in your kitchen and then you just consume it over the week, versus really dessert kind of products or products which you need to then process further and for dessert, for example?
So the desserts range is something that would be exclusive. Such gourmet desserts would be about 20% of our sale. Mm-hmm. But the sweets and the dessert business for us is about 55% of our sale. And the convenience snacks, which are consumed daily, is about 45% of our business.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how popular are the global brands for the Indian market? So I believe your product is very typical then. So many Indian people would know your product. But if like in a wholesale environment, like in a supermarket, your products are presented next to like a Nestle chocolate or whatever sweet product. So people rather pick than the international brands, or would they prefer like the Indian typical products over the international brands?
So it's still not that seamless in India. And chocolates that way, like say a company like Cadbury or Ferrero Rocher or Lindt would have their own aisles, and the Indian sweets would have their own aisles.
Mm.
So we don't necessarily compete on the same aisle or besides each other, but we will compete for the share of the bag or the share of the pocket area, where probably they might spend 20% on chocolates and 80% on Indian sweets, or vice versa. So that is where we compete.
Okay, got it. And then can you guide us a bit through your digital journey? So you have explained that initially it started with the stores because you needed them in order to process the dairy products. And then you expanded into like the wholesale business, where you're selling your dairy products, your snack, to other retailers. So what was the exact journey?
So what we realized is that there was a growing demand for digital business or digital ordering systems in this country. And during the last decade, there used to be a mass migration of Indians into countries abroad who wanted to order it online as well. And that's why we actually started just building a website and getting some sale of it. And we realized that there is good traction to be generated there, and actually better margins if we are able to do it at the right price. And that's where we started focusing that, why can't we look at the digital business to be equivalent to what at least one store business is trying to do?
Mm-hmm.
And that was our first problem statement, which we tried to address maybe back in 2015 or 14. And we started building a team around it. And that time the marketplace was relatively simpler compared to today in terms of how to acquire the consumer, or how to build the right ROAS, or how to get the ROC right. And what is the ad spend, and how do you build the tactics for different platforms, etc. But we matured into it eventually. And what we've come to see is that, again, inside the digital business, what we call as a vertical, there are a couple of caveats that come into it. So one is, of course, some sale that we drive through our website. Then the sale that we drive through third-party marketplaces like what Amazon or a Flipkart in India does. Then, we have other platforms which are about quick commerce, where the likes of Zomato or Swiggy or Instamart or Big Basket in India are really, really good. And they, through their warehousing and our own supply chain network, can probably deliver to the consumer orders in under 10 minutes or 20 minutes.
Mm.
And that's why what we've come to realize is that it's a very maturing marketplace, where the physical and the digital overlap each other very often. And the physical space can be utilized for a longer amount of time if we are able to plug it into the digital infrastructure. And that's what we've tried to enable.
But how do the quick commerce businesses work in India? Do they have their own dark warehouses, or do they use pickers like Instacart in the US, where they go to your store or like to a standard supermarket and pick from the aisle?
So it is based on the partner we work with. Some partners have their own stores. Some partners directly pick up from our stores and deliver it there. And for some, what we do is that we work with some partners specifically to let our own physical stores become their dark stores for our products. And then we spend more on advertising with them so that, you know, we are able to get the right kind of throughput for this. Because with any food business, your shelf life is very crucial and the product is valued if it is fresh. So that's why the freshness is what we sell on, and that is where the operationality of it becomes a very crucial task.
Yeah. And what you're describing sounds like a very modern approach to omnichannel, also like from a consumer perspective. So, and I guess you're like traveling the world a bit, and you're comparing how it's working in the US and maybe in Europe. And here in Europe, especially in Germany, it sometimes feels very hard to order. And apart from like the bigger cities, it's very hard to order online. And if there's like a quick commerce option, then there's only one and not two or three, or like in Dubai, 50 quick commerce options. So would you say it's a way more developed market in India already when it comes to customer experience?
It is. And I think what I would say is that as bad as it was for the world in terms of the lives lost, COVID was one of the biggest boom when it comes to digital businesses in this country. And buying habits of the people changed forever in India. And what we saw was a deeper penetration of digital businesses and digital ordering, even in the smaller towns in India. So that infrastructure just came up blazing fast, and it's serving where, you know, there are so many brands who are only digital brands now in India, and they, you know, they are generating a couple of $1 million turnover just selling one or two products if they want to.
Crazy. You have described like this status today, but I believe didn't start like, oh, when did it start, like the digital journey for your company? So when did you learn that, okay, it's not enough just to deliver to like to other wholesalers, to other supermarkets and deliver in your own store? Did you start maybe with like Amazon or Flipkart initially and then moved into other direct-to-consumer channels? Because if I go to your website today, it looks like a very modern online shop. So, but there must have been like a learning curve behind it.
Oh, yes, there was. And so Amazon and the Flipkarts came in much later. Before that, we had a website which was very basic. And, you know, it was just an add to cart, regular old website that would, you can imagine, back in 2012 or 13. And that's when we started working with a couple of platforms who were specializing on building digital businesses. So it's a evolutionary process. And what looks as a good image today is a journey of 8 years or 10 years where things are better. But I think things can be even better. And that is what we've set as a target for our next financial year, where, you know, we want to hit 4 times what we do right now every month as a digital business division. And that way now it's a separate P&L that we track inside our balance sheet as well. Because till one point it was too insignificant to track separately. But now the spend and the returns on it are so significant that it is something worth tracking.
Can you share like some overall numbers for your company? So how many people are work for your company, or what is like the turnover, though people have like an imagination about what size are we talking?
So at a group level, we are employing more than 2,500 people. On a direct basis, we work with more than 4,500 people who are working on the distribution side. From a procurement side, you know, we interact with more than 75,000 farmers from whom we procure the milk and actually process and make products out of it. And that way, our service network would be with around close to about 300 to 400 key vendors who keep supplying us. So that is the width of the people that we are able to handle. And at a top line, so we would be in the range of about in excess of 200 million euros.
Okay. And growing, I believe.
Yes, and growing at more than about 12 to 13% CAGR at a group level. And our product business has been growing at more than 20% over the last 5 years.
And when you're thinking now in like quadrupling your online business, or at least doubling it, what we are seeing in the European markets is that many companies that are moving into the digital platform economy are facing new rules. Because in the wholesale business, usually if you're selling like to a supermarket in India, they would buy your products from your company, and then they put their markup on top and then sell it. In the digital world, it kind of moves into a different order where you're the owner of the product, even though it's sold or offered on Flipkart or Amazon. You need to pay the platform on top with like online marketing costs or to reach the customer. And then when the product is sold, you ship it like from your warehouse, for example. So it's, they're not taking the inventory risk anymore. And yes. this, this leads to huge complications in organizations, because when you're moving from a wholesale business where you're selling like big bulks of products into more B2C like business, this obviously creates a lot of fringes in the org chart. Is it something you're seeing in your business already, or is this far ahead or only like a minor part of the online business?
No, it's already existing. And I think that is one of the big challenges that we have to face, because the way the taxation also happens, the inventory needs to be loaded at the right places at the right time, and the compliances need to be there for it. So that way, I think it is an operational issue more than anything else. And the more, you know, proactive you are as a management in terms of just setting the rules right, the better things get. But yes, I do believe that this is a very valid challenge that this industry faces. And the more it moves from, you know, a channelized tier level distribution where there was staging from A to B to C to D, where now the sale is happening from A to D directly and everything in between exists, but they did not come into the picture. So that's why it's going to be a challenge in terms of how to navigate those on the statutory side of compliances. But I must say that the Indian government has been very proactive in understanding this, and they have been issuing a lot of changes in policy. And we also have fortunately been having a minister on the IT side who's been very, very proactive. So that just, I think, makes things easier in terms of marketplace access as well.
And how important are marketplaces like Amazon or Flipkart for your business? Because like in the European countries, they kind of, Amazon failed, I think, is the biggest loser in the grocery business in Europe. So they had like a very, very progressive grocery strategy, but they kind of lost because they didn't apply to the rules that were existent in this kind of market. So how is it in India? So is Amazon, does it play any role in your category?
Oh, yes, it does. And it is an important category. I think what we face as a challenge as a food company is that sometimes the cost of logistics is higher than the cost of the product, because the way the logistics work is all on the volume business, and food occupies a lot of volume for very less weight. So it becomes an expensive proposition to manage. And that is where the decentralized warehousing works into the picture and makes things faster for us. So the likes of Amazon or Flipkart or India's very own marketplace, which is maturing now, which is called ONDC, is also built on the same lines. And with ONDC, I think the marketplace has been set to a free market ideology where other major competitors are following the same rules there. So I think it is not as dominant as a player in Europe, nor is it as likely to fail like it did in Europe, but it will always have competition which is localized, much leaner and much faster.
Yeah. Okay, that's very good to know. Then, and then there's like another important question which I wrote down before the podcast, which is like your direct to consumer strategy, because you have like a full fledged online shop. So, and you're saying you are even doing a delivery yourself. You have your you can deliver from your stores, from one of the 85 stores in the very dense populated areas. And if I would compare this, or if I were to compare this with companies in Europe in a similar category, snacks, I would say, they are very, very, how should I express this? Cautious about a direct-to-consumer business, because I say, you know, yes, Alex, we're selling snacks, Pringles, for example, whatever, but like the basket size is just not big enough. So, and we are competing with in a market where margins are thin anyway, and then we are becoming a competitor with our partners, and this leads to channel conflicts, and that's why we eventually decided against a full-fledged D2C strategy. So, just going through my head, like different brands, but there's very, very few with kind of a proof of concept website. Nobody has like a full-fledged, okay, you can get the whole assortment here. You're getting maybe special services here. You're getting recipes for our snacks here. That seems to be like an outlier. And even in your case, you're like serving one very special category, which is like maybe 10-15% of the overall grocery basket from a family. So you cannot do like your full grocery shop with your product. So how is this working out? So is the basket size big enough for you, or is D2C just a window to your business, to your products, and which is helping then the other channels?
So I think if I was to compare and how we tried to build this digital and physical strategy together was with, you know, we had a good reference point in Germany with the supermarket chain called Rewe. And they have this compact stores called Rewe Go, I believe. I've seen them in smaller locations where they're really small. But I don't think so. They enable the e-commerce part of it, where they don't use those stores as a service point. They only use it as a trading point. So we try kind of studied that model very well. And we just made sure that we enabled that digitally as well. So when we did that, what we were able to do is that what we sell with the supermarkets and the distributors is a limited range of products and categories with a limited range of packaging and a channel or a product categorization which is focused only for that domain. And when we go into the digital and the physical branded retail concept, we have a same product but packaged in a different category or packaged in a different form factor or a weight factor where we know that it is part of a bouquet. So that's why the product categorization and the product management becomes a very, very important task at your end. And I think the complexity of your product range makes it very difficult for grocers. So we've also come to the conclusion that where we from about 3 years ago when we had about 700 SKUs, we've actually gone down to 500. And I sometimes feel that all we need to do is about 200 because that is what is contributing about 85% of our sale. So it's always a yin-yang situation where you don't really have a very clear answer about it. But what's worked well for us is that product categorization and putting different packagings available in different markets suiting to the consumer who get into those markets is actually helping us make sure that there is no complaint in the channel. Mm. So we used to face a lot of complaints from our retailers or our supermarkets saying that, you know, if you are discounting this product there and we are discounting that product there, then that's going to trouble somebody else. So determining that as a product category management activity is something that the brands have to do very well. And unless you have a team inside who's doing that full time, it will be a very difficult thing to be sustainable in every domain profitably.
Okay, got it. When you're thinking about like quadrupling next year or this year, what are the channels you're focusing on? Is it direct to consumer channel? Is it the quick service delivery channel from your own stores? Is it maybe, or are you also counting in online sales from your wholesale partners?
Yes. So majority of the growth will come in from the quick commerce and third-party e-commerce channels where we will just work with them in a more integrated manner to provide marketing budgets as well as product availability at their places so that delivery and quick delivery is where we score on. Because all of these players are very much profitable when they do quick commerce, not necessarily profitable when they do e-commerce. So that's why the focus is on e-commerce and building value chain there. And the second would be in terms of the amount of spend we do and keep tracking as a ROAS for our own website sales. So that, you know, we are just able to do it right with the help of the search engines and digital marketing. And ensuring that we either drive the sale through our website or we drive it through third-party retailers. But that will be a smaller chunk. The bigger chunk will always be quick commerce.
Okay, that's cool. But you're not thinking about like expanding a dark store network where you could say, okay, let's open some more stores. But instead of having this customer-facing store part, which is expensive and hard to manage, let's only use like the 20% warehousing you're usually having in a store.
Precisely.
Yeah,
precisely. So when I say we enable quick commerce, what we do is we start dark stores that plug into the quick commerce network. So our inventory will be in those dark stores and they will be plugged into the digital system of multiple quick commerce players. So we don't need a store format or a display or a very fancy outlet for it. All we need is just racking systems there and two people who will just pack it and keep delivering 24 hours.
And it's hard to fathom the size of India if you're talking like to European people or like to US people. You have 85 stores now, which like, let's say for an average, in 80 different cities, which is like for an average European country, it's like full rollout. So how many more dark stores can you do in India until you hit like full coverage?
Oh, Well, I think we have potential for probably 2,000 dark stores across India. And east of India, which was something that, you know, nobody really thought even of marketing for the longest amount of time. The amount of development and infrastructure and the money that has come into the hands of people there and is likely to come over the next decade even more so. I was touring East India last week with my entire sales team just for the same. So what we see is that with the dark stores, probably 2,000 stores is what we need to plan at a dark level, just as fulfillment centers for plugging into all digital commerce business. And we will still be probably less than 5% of market share and for the entire turnover of it.
And East India is compared to West India underdeveloped, is how I understand it?
Yes.
So it's like Eastern Europe versus Western Europe kind of style?
Very much so.
Ah, okay. So. Why is that?
Well, because the western part of India was always something that became more predominant in terms of development, even when India was ruled by the British. So that's why that part of the country was always exposed to a lot of technology, a lot of trading and good ports as well. So that's why business was always rolling there and more people settled there. Also, the educational background here was great. There were a lot of colleges, universities. So people from East India just migrated to the West, got educated, either got employed there or, you know, went abroad and, you know, started making even better money there. So the East was never developed as prominently as it has been over the last 5 years, maybe.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. That's totally news for me. It makes sense now you're describing it.
To give you a perspective of, you know, what those 85 stores mean. So just imagine entire Netherlands and the part from, say, the Dutch border going up to Frankfurt off Germany. That's just what we covered with 85 stores. And if India is the rest of Europe, that is everything else that is around is being developed right now.
Okay. For the ones listening now to this podcast saying, okay, so maybe India is a market I should have like a deeper look. So what is like for entrepreneurs or like interested entrepreneurs, like a good place to start? Where should we book our next vacation in India to get like an understanding? So where India is moving?
So, there are four big cities in India which are really, really good from commerce as well as technology as well as, you know, very young culture. So one, I would say, is Gurgaon, which is a suburb of Delhi. The second city would be Hyderabad, which is in the central part of the country. The third city would be Pune, which is where we are headquartered in. And the fourth city would be Bangalore, where, you know, we have every tech company, you name it, it's there. And, you know, one of the highest per capita incomes in the country. So these four cities are a right blend of what modern India looks like. Of course, you have the regulars like Mumbai and Kolkata and Chennai and maybe Ahmedabad. But they are very heavy on industries and manufacturing and not as much as into technology and startups and the culture of new money that is coming into India. So this is where you should see and understand the commerce of the country and then probably have a vacation up north if you want to do skiing in Kashmir or if you want to enjoy the desert in Rajasthan or just enjoy the beautiful landscapes of Kerala, which is there in the south of India.
But for people that can afford like doing vacations everywhere in the world, and I would assume you're like one of these one of these persons. So is it now more interesting to stay in India and to like to use some of the newly developed resorts, or do you still move out to, I don't know, Dubai or Thailand or whatever?
Well, so what I would say is that I have two ways of looking at it. One is that when it comes to hospitality, I think we are way ahead in terms of Dubai or Thailand, unless we are talking only Four Seasons and the St. Regis and one and only category of resorts. The average Indian hospitality is at a much higher level than these countries. But now the resort and the tourism in India is so occupied and Indians are just traveling so much inside the country that it's much more expensive to take a vacation in India than, you know, going to Dubai or in Thailand.
Really?
So a night in Goa is going to be more expensive than a night in Dubai for the same category of hotels.
Interesting. So that really is a sign for like a booming for a booming economy.
And one of the main reasons for this is that, you know, when it was 2010, India had about 100 airports. Now India has about 250 airports. And India wants to have 500 airports in the next decade.
How are they doing this? So, like, I don't know if you have heard about the German example of the airport in Berlin that took us like 10 years longer. And it was not even a new one. It's a renovated. It was a renovated one, more or less. So,
I've had a chance to live in Germany, actually, very close to Dusseldorf.
Ah, okay.
But that's why I know the running joke about the Berlin airport. Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy what's happening. Like, as I told you, I was in Uttar Pradesh last week and they're building a new airport. And what they thought would take 5 years, they're going to finish it in 3 years. So, and it's going to be the largest airport in Asia.
The largest in Asia. So we're not talking about like an airport with like 1 million passengers a year, but like an airport with like 50 minutes. It's as big as Istanbul.
No, that's probably 100 million passengers. So we already have two airports in India which are handling more than 50 million passengers a year. So that's now not enough. That is the situation. So what we've seen is that with the rise of the spending population and airline connectivity everywhere, people are just traveling very well. And the way we have some low-cost carriers in this country like IndiGo or now with Air India being sold to Tata, it's just phenomenal what's going to happen with air travel. So, you know, even red-eye flights are full nowadays. And I'm surprised because that was not the case a decade ago when I used to travel.
And how much is it if you like go from Pune, you are located right now, to I don't know, Chennai, like, which is like, let me look on the map, which is like 1,000, which is like one travel all over Europe, just size wise. Yeah. How much is it?
So if I was to go from Pune to Chennai and if I plan it well, so that's going to cost me maybe about 150 euros to just travel on air, going back and forth.
Hmm.
And probably to stay based on where I want to stay, like Chennai has some really good properties. So if I stay at the Leela there, it's going to probably cost me about 300-400 euros. But, you know, that I'll be treated like a king there.
Okay. But it really sounds like, you know, like when a friend of mine was traveling India like 10, maybe 12 years ago, and he did like a motorbike tour through India. And he said, you know, Alex, we don't need to be afraid of like Indian development. The country is so poor and like it's like there's so much stuff to do. Forget about it, like focus on China, whatever. What you're describing is like it's very different. So it feels like a big part of the infrastructure is way more developed than what we have in Europe. And in Europe, is infrastructure is aging, obviously. And hospitality levels are on par or even better than in some of the resort countries like Thailand or Dubai. It really sounds like hard to believe.
Yeah, so I've had a chance to live in Europe between 2011 and 12. And I probably end up visiting Europe because of equipment or trade shows almost 3 or 4 times a year. So back in 2010, 11 or 12, when I lived there, India was a very, very different India. And, you know, we would not always have the first choice that, you know, I want to go back to India was not something that every Indian staying abroad would say. Just because we've had a very stable central government under the leadership of our prime minister in India, they have understood that all they needed to fix was the infrastructure and access. So both these things have been solved so very well in this country that now I very often feel that, you know, so we have a subsidiary in the US as well. And very often, even the most developed states in the US are now lagging in infrastructure compared to what we have in India.
Yeah, but that was the case already 10 years ago. So the infrastructure in the US is pretty much compared to what you can find in Egypt or Tunisia.
And I think that's just amazing. And also, I think what we've understood well from the Europeans is about building a good train network, which is now happening. So in fact, just yesterday, I had prepared a new note for our ministry in terms of making it a multinodal transport hub system so that the cost of travel of goods between South India to North India will be reduced even further. And the ministry has taken it up proactively where, you know, we have a minister who's a Wharton educated guy. And, you know, he's just more than keen to see how this can be developed in under 6 months. So if they just keep doing this at that speed, I think it's a very, very great situation for businesses to be in, because all we require as businesses is speed. That's where government can either slow you down or help you. And that's what I think we've been helped.
Yeah, and that's actually what we are describing usually in the podcast. There's like only one winning strategy or only one strategy that persists. The companies that are adapting faster to what like customer needs or market needs are winning. It's not a question of size or money or whatever. And this also seems to be adaptable to countries. So it's really nice. So you definitely raised my interest in traveling to India in the next decade and to visit some of the places. Sounds fantastic. So, and then maybe my last question is, so you're saying you're exporting into Europe some of your products. So what is the best place in Germany to buy some of your products? Is it Rewe?
Oh, I wish we reach that situation soon. we don't get into German supermarkets yet, but I'm hoping we can do that soon. But we have a very good super stockist for Germany who's based out of Munich. And that way, this person is ensuring that, you know, all our load is stored in their container systems and in their distribution warehouses there. And we are distributing from anywhere as north as Berlin into Hamburg, Frankfurt, going into Cologne, Aachen, which is housing a lot of Indian students, then Nuremberg, Würzburg, south as well into Stuttgart and many of the smaller towns as well.
So you are doing it? You're sending out like parcels via DHL or Hermes, or how do you do it?
So we ship containers of the products which are dry, and then we do some air cargo of the products which have shorter shelf life, but they have good demand there.
But what is the retail outlet? Where can I buy it? Is it like specialized stores on Indian products?
So this is mostly the Indian stores. And I can probably, what town are you based out of?
Close to Kiel. It's almost a Danish border, very in the north.
I know Kiel. I've been there.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
So in fact, our city and the University of Kiel had a technology tie-up, which we'd done before. So
very cool. So before we are exchanging like information on like good vacation goals, I'd like to thank you for being in the podcast and sharing all the learning curve and getting us a bit more excited about the Indian market. Sounds really great. Thank you, Indrajeel.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for talking, Alex.